I just remember this really incredible time where every West Indian had a sewing machine. We used to buy patterns. And I remember we used to have a style where we'd wear the suit, very crisp suit, with green flash.
Yeah.
And no socks.
Hey, welcome back to The Process, our third season of the Somerset House podcast, looking at the creative process with artists from the community here. I'm Laurent John, a producer at Somerset House Studios. Every episode, we follow an artist as they dig deep into a new idea that's come out of their practice to see where it goes next. We've looked at all sorts, the world of financial astrology, how art can be a form of exorcism, and tried to bottom out why AI developers are so secretive. In the last series, we primarily followed artists from the studios community, our community of artists based here at Somerset House, making work. This series, we're focusing a bit more on the exhibitions program and the artists and curators who feature within that. So for this episode, we're kicking off with Andrew Eby from Bold, the collective who curated The Missing Thread, exploring untold stories of Black British fashion. Black creativity has had a profound impact on British culture, but it hasn't always been acknowledged. The Missing Thread looks to rectify that, piecing together the story of Black fashion in Britain through photography, music, and subculture, documenting the artists who've often flown under the radar. Here, Andrew digs into one period which he thinks was particularly influential, a time between the mid-80s and mid-90s, which he's calling the Black British Renaissance. For me, if there's one band who really soundtracked that era, it's got to be Soul to Soul. So I was super excited to hear that for this episode, Andrew is joined by the legendary Jazzy B.
My name is Andrew Eby. I'm one of the co-curators of The Missing Thread at Somerset House and one member of the Bold Creative Agency. I also trained as a fashion designer, specifically in menswear, and work as an academic. So during the process of working through all the research for The Missing Thread, so starting around 1970 and moving through to around 2005, it becomes clear there's a period, really, from, I'd say, the mid-80s to the mid-90s, where we see artists like Chris Afile and designers like Joe Casey-Hayford. We're seeing Nina Vacomo, and they're not necessarily connected, but they're all working in these pockets of the country. You know, Birmingham, Manchester, Leeds. And we're seeing this response that's so similar but disconnected. But when you piece it all back together, it's quite clear that there's a clear picture of a Black British Renaissance. And this period is really important to Black fashion and style. In working through the research for The Missing Thread and understanding that Black fashion and style culture doesn't necessarily come from the same place of the Western fashion world, we can really see how fashion elevates through elements like music, for instance. What I'd really like to find out in this podcast is the legacy of some of those missing voices or those missing threads that we know exist, but in a way are lost from the mainstream conversation.
Well, we became the runway.
That's it.
We were the living runway for Wagwan with everybody. And we weren't just a normal sound either, because our thing was based against the arts.
What is called sound? We're a sound system.
So slap bang in the middle of that period, so around 1989, we see the emergence of Jazzy B and Soul to Soul. Has an incredible impact on Black culture, and it straddles music, style, fashion, dance, has a huge impact on club culture and clubland, but it defines a new era of Blackness and specifically around the Black British identity. So Jazzy B is a major player in The Missing Thread and this Black British Renaissance.
And through our style, you know, people just came to recognise us as the
this speculation is that culturally up and down the country, whether it's photography, art, fashion, music, that we're all almost like working to the same drumbeat, but almost separate. And I think some of it's about resistance as well and the politics of the time. Were you aware of like sort of different versions of soul to soul in other parts of the UK or?
We're always about being international. That was the whole premise of what we were doing. And the vibe about us from Chapel Town in Leeds all the way down to St. Paul's, Bristol, all the places we played regular. And it's the sound system. The sound system is the Google of the whole thing. You feel me? And there was politics, there was, you know, rock and roll, there was music, there was poets, there were artists, I mean, physical artists. And, you know, a Sunday night between 10 o'clock and 1 a.m., you'd see people in everything from denim to the highest quality knitted, woven wool. And we had everything from the ripped up jeans all the way through to leathers and that whole bomber jacket look that was going on. The tribal mix up. And when I talk about the runway, I mean, everybody looked like somebody.
Yeah.
I mean, right. When we were coming up, everyone looked like somebody. And there was this level of being able to identify with one another, even if you were up north.
Because again, the speculation is around how we present ourselves, you know, because we're trying to establish an identity or a new identity that hasn't been, you know, it's not been outlined yet. We're defining ourselves. Now, I've got a good question. It's about Soul to Soul, the Funky Dread. And in a way, it is its own subculture. Is that how you see it, Jazzy? Do you see it that way?
Definitely, because we were looking for our own. We're trying to smell our own kind of thing. We love the idea of the Rasta thing wrapped up in Christianity. In actual fact, the original hairstyle was born out of living in a Christian household. And I used to wear a red, gold and green little hat and I shaved round the sides just so my mum couldn't see the locks. Because according to them people, you were a vagabond and all that. Yeah. Those style and that fashion was definitely born from that. And then an encounter that I had in Lalo, in the cafe one day, where there was a little time when a lot of yard man was here, you know what I mean? Disturbing the peace. I called them rap attackers backers. And one of them held a knife to my neck one time on the pool table and said if I couldn't make up my mind whether I was a dread or a barlid, he would do it for me. And again, there was this moment of clarity. Rotted. And I just felt this thing rise above all of that. It just elevated me to another level. As a youth, what I found myself doing as I grew up was looking at my brother's Stay Press, was looking at all the flaps that they used to make on the trousers, and then doing your own kind of configuration of it. Hence the funky dreads, being in the bedroom, your imagination's running well. You know, I was always into like funkadelic and all those kind of things. And the weirdest thing is many of the other guys as well picked up on the same vibe at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, listening to it's really interesting because, you know, I studied design, right? So I went off to London College of Fashion and done tailoring.
Right.
Did you ever think of going down that route?
So. Fantastic. I'm glad you brought that up. Because I did. I was a pattern cutter for a good while.
Okay, it's all making sense now.
Right.
It's all making sense.
Going to little workshops. Yeah. Listen, from Boys Brigade to Army Cadets.
Boys Brigade.
You stitch up your own things.
Yeah.
See, when we were spooning our boots, our stuff was dandamite, not dynamite. Our stuff was explosive. I mean, you know, all of those little bits of detail were the difference. So when man was rocking sovereigns, we'd be wearing ducats. When they were in ducats, I'd gone back to Africa.
Yeah,
them kind of things there, that whole Afrocentricity, the vibe that even we came with from maybe 85 and beyond, the flag that we were flying, really was quintessentially right. British. It was this right. London thing solidifying who and what we were.
Yeah, I mean, that was the other thing, that the connectivity between punk yeah. and blackness is really interesting.
Class.
Because what's missing from the story is really black people mm. amongst and around punk and the influence on punk, right?
Yeah.
Which was, you know, for us it's easy to see, but actually for the wider world, you know, punk belonged to Westwood, say, you know, and it becomes a very kind of white institution. So again, it's something, you know, that the show is kind of looking at,
and right,
and you know, you're part of that story too. For me, it's a, you know, it's an honor to speak to you about this, because right. I see you as a really big component of what we see now. So everything that comes after the kind of the 90s in terms of black culture really stems from this moment where, you know, people like Soul to Soul and people like Oswald, Casely Hayford, but even people like Bruce Oldfield, strangely
yeah,
enough,
yeah, absolutely,
you know,
yeah.
you know, who wasn't, is not often included in that conversation, gives us the ability to think huge. You know, we yeah. can dress princesses mm-hmm. if we really want to.
I mean, even for me, as a number 14 bus was my transport back in the day, I remember even seeing people on, you know, who worked in London Transport. You see how crisp they look compared to their counterparts? So with that styling thing, I guess, is kind of in us. It's really embedded in us, you know, even when you come down to the derelict look.
Yeah, yeah.
That, you know, man is not even trying to put two and four together. It's just happening.
Yeah, yeah.
We just seem to pick these things out righteously, and it's just so organic, and it seems to fit the sense of the humour yeah. and maybe what you're trying to portray out there, even if it's like, don't trouble me. I remember when I first got signed to Virgin, and in them days it was apartheid, so I sat down in the reception, me and H sat down in reception of Virgin Music until 9 p.m. when the cleaners was coming, and they bypassed us. The meeting was supposed to be at 6.
Wow.
And because we looked so different, right, they thought we were just punks, and they were scared to actually talk to us. You know what I mean? This is black people.
Yeah, yeah, wow.
This is
wow.
black people wow. because the division is black. You understand?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Then we went into a car because I wanted to go to a club at the time called Zanzibar. My friend was playing there, and they weren't allowed to drive over the bridge. You couldn't get a cab in them days. Mick Clark, God rest his soul, he was the A&R man that signed us. He flagged down a cab for us in Manhattan. We got into the taxi, and because the white man had said something, you know, he was talking and flagged the cab there. This is a black lady driving and everything. But when she turned around, she got the biggest fright of her life because she's hearing two black guys speaking English.
English, yeah, 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 of course.
Homegirl went into a glove compartment and drew for a gun.
Whoa.
Yeah, that's how things used to be back in the day.
Wow.
And thank goodness I had the passport on me because I didn't have a good American accent.
Whoa.
And tried to yard licks on her and showed her the English passport. And she stayed with us all day and gave us breakfast the next day. And in turn, the reason why that conversation is so significant is because you could speak to anyone during that period of time of what was actually happening. The heart of the Americas, what we deem America, is not New York. It's Midwest is America. It's like when you come to London, it's not Britain. You go up, sir. And that is a thing where I think we were able to define our own because we're from this melting pot. We're multifaceted. And within that, not like a chameleon, but with us, when in a room, we have our own little yeah. vibe. And I feel that this pin drop Britain, maybe the punk attitude, but when we travel, we're boss.
I couldn't begin to overstate the impact of Jazzy, Soul to Soul, on UK black culture. I actually don't know where to begin. Do you know, it's funny, I did write Jazzy an email recently and I said, I can't unpick your impact from my life because it's so embedded to the point that I feel like you're family.
So around sort of 2005, 2006, 2007, we see the emergence of Martine Rose, who's a black British fashion designer. And many of her references are taken from subcultures, music culture. We see her referencing artists like Soul to Soul and Jazzy B.
I feel like everyone was impacted by Soul to Soul when they were on Top of the Pops. The whole family, I mean, we'd be calling each other, going, he's on, Jazzy's on. It didn't matter who you were, where you came from. It was a UK sound.
So Martine is a very important current fashion designer. I mean, having been worn by, you know, artists like Rihanna, Drake and Kendrick Lamar. So she has an innate connectivity back into music anyway. And I think that's really, again, you know, that process of black fashion culture now really establishing itself. You know, her role at Balenciaga, for instance, and, you know, working on with Nike ahead of the Women's World Cup. It shows you the progress that black designers have made. So I'm really curious to know what impact that time period had on Martine and her work. And then the other thing I'm really interested in is if she's aware of this kind of black Renaissance period that existed that we're speculating on.
One of my cousins was into like rave music and everything that was happening at that time in 1989. It was like at its peak probably. And I remember sitting, because everyone, all the kids after Camden Palace used to gather on Clapham Common. And my nan, I mean, bless her, after church, she used to take me and my other cousins who were around the same age as me. And we used to sit on the common and we watched this explosion. It was the first time I'd seen football hooligans who up until that point had been a reason to cross the road, dancing with rusters, dancing with hippies, dancing with... It was unbelievable. I'm actually getting goosebumps when I think about it. It felt so alive. And, you know, Keep On Moving was that sound. Sade, Nena, Jazzy, there weren't many black people, black British people at that, visible. Do you know what I mean? Visible on Top of the Pots and all of that sort of stuff. So, and being young, I thought that everyone was our cousin. I felt like that was a family member. So they felt like extensions of us. And I think that was partly the magic, I think.
So when you start to think about the emergence of the music and the scenes, and then of course, you know, the scenes need style and the scenes craft their own style. So, I mean, your work kind of really plays on, you know, understanding kind of music and culture and subculture and Britishness. How did you sort of pick up on that?
Absolutely. But I didn't, you know, I wasn't interested in fashion design until way later. That, like, fashion seemed like something that had nothing to do with me, really. Abstract, white, posh. It just felt like I didn't care. The only brands that I really paid any attention to were brands that had infiltrated subculture in some way. So Jean-Paul Gaultier, Versace, Moschino, Helen Story, Pam Hogg. There was stuff like that, Sign of the Time, you know, a few shops and stuff. But that was style to me, that because it was worn in a certain way. It was worn with different things and it was clothing. I was so curious about what people were wearing, why they were wearing it, where they were wearing it, and the differences in what my cousins and my sisters and stuff would, how they would express their particular style through clothing. But even that didn't translate into fashion until much later, until after when I did my first foundation at the end of that year. I was like, oh, maybe it is fashion. But up until then, I just loved clothes, but I didn't love fashion.
I mean, I had the same issues, like a designer and trying to kind of feel connected to fashion as an industry. And so, like, kind of Friday or Saturday night was the big kind of fashion night. And that was, central ideas were really around music.
Yeah.
And then, of course, these kind of forming subcultures.
Yeah.
that was kind of subverting style that then becomes fashion.
Yeah, absolutely. It was first and foremost about expression, and it wasn't about, it was like no one wanted to look the same, like at all. It was a very subversive approach to fashion.
I mean, you know, you're a trailblazer. That's the other thing.
I don't know about that, Andrew.
But... No, you're a black woman doing menswear, firstly. You're probably one of the first, right?
Yeah.
You're changing the way that we are viewing black men as well. And I think this is really important. For a long time, there's only been a singular narrative usually told by black men. So apart from really Joe, there was never any kind of sensitivity or difference around black style. Yeah. As you've pointed out, normality or a hoodie or, you know, a sweatshirt wasn't necessarily seen on the runway, but it was seen in the nightclub. And if you like, the nightclub is kind of our version of the runway.
100%. That's true. I mean, it's one of the reasons that I use loafers, you know, those square toed loafers. And that is a little bit of a comment on club culture. You know, if you were black, there was the hostile door policies in most clubs up until shockingly recently, but particularly back then. And so there was no way you were going to get in trainers or nothing. So it was like this homage to like that period where it would be this smart mixed with other little flashes of style mixed in there. But it always is going back to the nightclub somehow.
I think UK Garage was...
Oh, UK, exactly. That's what comes to my mind. UK Garage was definitely a moment for that, where it's when we see the head-to-toe Moschino, or the Moschino mixed with the Versace, mixed with the Patrick Cox, mixed with a Versace... You know, remember the Versace glasses with the gold, the massive... Do you remember that?
Yeah.
They had big gold cat heads on the side, and it was just taken to the extreme. I loved it. It was this flashiness that was just this... It was amazing.
We talk about the missing thread, and one of the things, yeah, we know that Soul to Soul has a fashion element to it. But one of the things I didn't know that you was trained as a pattern cutter.
Well, so, you know, when I say all of us dabble, because 90% of the sound man were tailors or carpenters.
Yeah.
Right? So that went hand in hand. When, you know, when you wanted your trousers just to come just over the ankle, and you buy your mohair material and rear, it was all a part of that. But amazingly, yeah, from the Singer machine to the... On a Sunday, my sister used to cut out patterns from crochet, mummy doing and auntie doing crochet, making birds, to my first Ike's Golden Green hat, which was actually knitted. And there was a thing about... You could tell when someone had a knitted vest against something that they bought that was made by a machine.
Yeah, yeah.
And we laughed at that. I remember a great time, though. So to cut, I just remember this really incredible time where every West Indian had a sewing machine. We used to buy patterns. I remember one of the first times hanging out with probably Christopher Nemeth and them guys. And the thing what I loved was the fact that the fabric stayed in shape. And I remember it put me back in the mind of when, you know, the old reggae guys, how when they used to dress really crisp. And I remember we used to have a style where we'd wear the suit, very crisp suit, with green flash.
Yeah.
And no socks. I even remember that style from the 70s, my brother wearing a crochet thing, platforms, and a handbag. And then seeing another picture of Al Green, and everyone was trying to emulate, because there was a point where stylers from the, I don't know, 70s, mid-70s to about, you know, 70, maybe 82, the styling was off the Richter scale when it came down to our culture, particularly in the Americas. And what we were able to do with this detailed tailoring thing here in Europe, I mean, that's why, for me, Joe Casely Hayford rides so high. Because what he done, he gentrified me in a way that was beyond... It was... I'm going to sound weird. It was beyond gentrification, because even the establishment would look and think, ooh,
Yes.
I got a picture of us in the Joe Casely Hayford, the same stripes like I'm rocking today, yeah, but it was Joe's vibe and it was linen. And the king now, I used to run Princess Trust recording studios, and he came to meet me one time and I thought, how would I look? And I was so proud to wear this thing, yellow and brown. That's the second thing he commented on, my threads. And I was just like, yeah, you know. So that was the vibe for me. Yeah.
And it again is, you know, Joe.
Yeah, that was Joe.
There's one
fight. He had the guy's a visionary.
And to be honest with you, it's what you do with music is essentially what Joe's doing with fashion. Okay. Do you see what I mean? So all those complex identities that come from, because Joe's of Ghanaian heritage. Right. So he's observing, you know, the islands and the communities and London and what it is to be British. And so all of those elements that you're putting into your music, he's putting into his clothes.
We were hand in glove.
Now, here's the thing. Here's the funny thing. Joe was also could have been a music man.
Word.
Did you see what I mean? And it's just like you
could have been
a clothes man. Yeah. Did you see what I mean? Yeah. So it's a really...
That's very interesting, that is.
Again, it's not necessarily... When you read through the annals of you know, subcultural history, mm-hmm. there's not necessarily always a section about the funky dread. So we need to lobby for that to be part of that culture.
Okay.
You know, Rude Boy, you know, ska, mod, funky dread. There's one last question. It's about a youngish designer. Martin Rose.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
He's a massive fan of yours.
North London, isn't it?
North London. She's pretty fabulous. Just wondering if you're familiar with her work or
it's a beautiful thing with Martine because it resonates and what her vibe and, again, the name almost being like a new name. I was introduced by my son.
Ah, there you go.
It don't get any bigger than that.
No, honestly,
it just doesn't get any bigger than that. My generation is the coolest generation that ever existed on the planet Earth. So for my youth, them to come and be waking me up like that now, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, really, truly inspiring me. I just think it's amazing. That conduit.
She runs under the radar as well.
That's a beautiful thing.
It's a really beautiful, especially now.
It's a great thing, Martine. You need to hold that harness and hold that down, bottle that, because, yeah, that's something where the character of that is where the length is for me, because otherwise it's a burnout thing. Yeah,
agreed.
I've worked with a few musicians. I mean, you know, when I worked with Kendrick recently on his tour thing, I think I really underestimated that. I didn't really think about it too much. And, oh my God, he invited me to the concert. I went to go and see it. And I didn't really think. And then I saw him come out in it and I just went bananas. Like it was, I was screaming like a child. And then when I met him it was so exciting to see him in it, because I'm not really fanny about anyone. Do you know what I mean? I've never really been a fan. I'm like a real fanny person. As a kid, I didn't have posters of anyone on my wall or whatever. I was just, I don't know. So I was obviously really pleased when he approached me, but I didn't think that much about it. You know, it was like, this is a wonderful project. Yeah, we'll work it. And when he came out in it, I was just like, oh my God, this poet, I cannot believe he's like potentially a voice of a generation, like this articulate, beautiful, exciting sound. And he's wearing my thing. And then when I met him afterwards, it was like meeting a family member, honestly. Yeah, it was really special. So that's not going to happen with everyone, do you know? And that just doesn't happen with everyone. But really there has to be some sort of synergy with someone, or I'm not. If there's not, I just...
And I'm presuming that Kendrick was knocking on your door, right? you don't have to answer that. But again, it's that purist approach that's always in your work.
It's always weird. It's always a bit of a surprise, because I'm always like, some of the things that I propose, they're not easy. You know what I mean? It's not pure street style, or it's not pure, you know what I mean? It's this sort of like... a tricky proposal sometimes. So I'm always really surprised when I have this big stars or whatever are saying, can I borrow this? And you're like, oh, wow.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been said that, you know, you're kind of one of the final brands that really gets and understands subculture. And where do you think, I mean, subculture's played an enormous part of our identity. Mm. So with that kind of a sense that we're losing subcultures, is that something you think, or do you think new spaces emerge?
I think that there are absolutely spaces that are emerging. My God, I need to believe that there are spaces emerging for young people to do what they need to do, because it's a need to be finding ways to express their experience. We all need it, because without that, we're fucked. I genuinely think that. I think that we are. So I need to believe that that is happening in corners and pockets all over the world that I'm completely unaware of. It seems like we are in a period of mediocrity at the moment, and it's the mainstream acceptance of mediocrity has reached probably peak. And I think once the pendulum is so far one way, and it's sort of capitalist sort of commerce at its absolute most pronounced, that there has to be a pendulum swing the other way. That's the exciting thing. That's the most exciting thing about culture, isn't it? It's like endlessly renewing.
You know what? I totally agree with Martine. I was thinking exactly the same thing. Jazzy does sound quite like family. So many of my uncles or cousins from that Windrush generation speak with a joyful expressiveness that instantly brings you into their world. And Jazzy was a pattern cutter originally. Who knew? So fascinating to hear how so many men in that era were tailoring their own clothes. I did not know that. Thanks to Andrew Eby, to Jazzy B, to Martine Rose. Perhaps a collaboration on the horizon there? That would be something quite special. The Missing Thread exhibition is sponsored by Morgan Stanley. This series of The Process is produced by Alana Chance and presented by me, Laurent John, for Somerset House. The exec producer is Eleanor Scott. The theme music is by Carl Beard, and the series is mixed by Nick Ryan. If you're enjoying the series so far and have time to send us a review or a rating, we'd love to hear from you. See you next time.